This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Does reality exist outside of human consciousness? If reality does exist outside our consciousness, how can we access it? Is there something outside of space and time? Is there a logic to our emotions? Has science ever been right about anything? Can science and religion be reconciled, or are they one and the same? Are people who seek the truth more likely to die? And what happens when we find out that what our fathers told us isn't true? This is my interview with Donald Hoffman. So I'm sitting on the campus of UC Irvine in the office of Professor Donald Hoffman, who is, I think, in agreement with me on a very important topic for me that's gotten me into a lot of trouble. But I drove all the way from the Bay Area this morning to find out whether we do agree. And maybe we could have covered this on the phone. Maybe this is going too far out of the way. But you and I are critics of this concept of reality, or at least the way it's deployed, both in science and in popular culture and in sort of the public consciousness. And we'll get into your particular argument against reality and my particular argument against reality. But what I find fascinating is that we come at it from completely different places. So you're a scientist, you're a neuroscientist, you come from the world of cognitive science, right?
Right.
And I come from history and philosophy and anthropology, but we both are sharp critics, again, of this idea of reality or truth existing outside of human consciousness. Is that fair to say?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the way I put it. But I want to start with something that might be surprising to you. I want to start with our fathers.
Okay.
Okay? Because I've heard that your father was a preacher. Is this right?
That's right. He was a fundamentalist minister.
Wow.
Right.
So what kind? What
denomination? Protestant. So okay. Protestant, even all the way with the Holy Roller, speaking in tongues kind of things.
Pentecostal?
So, some form of Pentecostal.
Oh,
so
wow.
Right. So he's interesting because he had a master's degree in chemistry, and then he also got a master's degree in counseling psychology.
No kidding.
And so he's a licensed therapist. So was my mom. She had a master's degree in family counseling and so forth. And so they were well-educated, but they were also quite fundamentalist in their views. And he was a chemist with a master's degree who believed the earth is only 6,000 years old. So it's an interesting interesting contradiction.
And he certainly had a very firm belief in truth and reality, didn't he?
Right. Well, that every verse in the Bible is absolutely true, and mm-hmm. it's the word of God.
And real.
And real, absolutely. And also that people who didn't believe the way he believed, would go to hell and things like that. So it was pretty strong notion of reality and right and wrong. And
yeah. So basically, you've been undergoing an Oedipal struggle against your father with this project. Is that right? To overthrow his worldview?
Well, I'm sure that psychologically it's been not easy for me because of that. It was very difficult to tell him years ago that I was doing evolutionary modeling when he...
Oh, that alone, right? Because you use evolutionary theory, unlike me, again, to go after reality. But right. just challenging reality and truth must have been hard for him, right?
Right, but to do it using evolution with natural selection,
which
is, the devil, mm-hmm. was not easy. So, but, and I think that actually that conflict with my dad probably delayed my progress on this work for probably at least a decade. It probably pushed it back for decade. Right. I didn't start this until the evolutionary work until maybe 2008, 2009. I probably, without that kind of pushback from my parents and my internalization of that pushback, I might have done it a decade or even 15 years earlier. We jumped onto it. I mean, I was interested in the evolutionary stuff, but I think subconsciously there may have been pushback within me because of the way I was raised, and I finally got over it and jumped in and learned the mathematics and went after it.
And were you how late in life were you religious in that way?
Well, I probably into my 30s. It took me, into my 30s before I could start to walk away from it. So I wasn't like the rebellious son who, as a teenager, just walked away. Mm-hmm. It was a slow process for me to sort of disentangle what was nonsense from what seemed to be more realistic or more a better view of life than I'd gotten.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. But you took at least a step away from them right away when you went to college, didn't you? You went to UCLA and majored in things you weren't supposed to major in, right? Yeah. Or studied things you weren't supposed to study in.
Well, yeah, quantitative psychology at UCLA, and that was fine. I mean, because it was just psychology, and so they didn't mind that too much, because eventually they had themselves became psychotherapists. Mm-hmm. So psychology, that wasn't off the charts. But then when I went to MIT. Again, that wasn't a big problem for them. I was going to study artificial intelligence and what's now the brain and cognitive science department. That seemed, I think, they didn't like that I was going across the country. They live in Southern California. They were a bit surprised I was going to take off and go across the country. But by that time, I was in my early 20s. I was going to do whatever I was going to do.
Right.
So they weren't going to get in the way. So I think but it was when I started to think out of the religious box and start to question.
And was that in grad school at MIT?
I started even before. Mm-hmm. I would start. Of course, I was thinking out of the box, but I didn't really begin to conclude for myself that many of the things I'd been taught were just flat out false. That takes a long time, and it's not just an intellectual endeavor; it's an emotional one, right? Because as a child, you're taught that to even question this stuff is an act of disbelief, and disbelief sends you straight to the fires of hell. Yeah. So when they cut you off at the legs early on, you're not allowed to even question this stuff. That's really tough. But that was part of what later on in life really made me go back and question the whole thing, right? If I'm not allowed to question this at all, there's something deeply wrong, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and a God who would send you to hell because you have an intellectual curiosity, what kind of God is that? So
it's an anti-intellectual God.
Right.
Which they all are.
So those kinds of things, but again, the emotional programming is very, very deep. The amygdala and is very, very powerful, and so it takes a long time to disengage from that. So whereas my younger brother, I mean, I sort of was the conformist. My younger brother sort of backed away even in his early 20s in a big, big... So it was, again, part of a personality thing, my personality versus my younger brother's and so forth.
Yeah.
It took me a longer time to back away. Yeah, but when I did, then I backed away big time.
That's fascinating. And were they ever angry at you for this?
I would say they were disappointed, and my dad never cut me off in the sense that he didn't say, well, because you don't believe, I'm not going to talk with you or anything like that. He always hoped to sort of bring me back in to his way of thinking. And he also, my work on consciousness, he liked that, I mean, because I was saying that space and time aren't fundamental. And he agrees with that.
I have heard religious people take that line as well.
Oh, absolutely. Space and time aren't fundamental. There's a reality that's much deeper than space and time. So that part they like, but then my theory of consciousness wasn't just sort of lining up with what they thought were the biblical ideas about what should be behind space and time. So then he would try to bring it back into his way of thinking about it and so forth. So it's interesting, and it's good for me because that kind of background really gave me a firsthand understanding of the difference between science and spirituality and the questions that they ask and the style that they answer them and the strengths and weaknesses of each approach. So I really got immersed in both worlds. And I think that's, eventually we'd like to get a rapprochement between them in a way that's beneficial. So
how would we do that?
Well, not easily. Each side has, I think, something really good to contribute. and has its own problems. So I think the spiritual traditions ask really good questions. Who are we?
Okay.
Why are we here? What is this all about? And some scientists will say that that's not in the purview of science.
Okay, yep.
I think it is. And I think for most scientists, it is in their purview and they have an answer. Mm-hmm. We are nothing but atoms.
Okay.
And there is no deeper meaning except the meaning that we give. And maybe our meaning comes from the shortness of life, the fact that life is so short that makes it precious and that gives it its meaning. Mm-hmm. And is there life after death? Of course not. Your brain dies, and with it, everything that the brain creates, including your consciousness. So they have commitments on the big questions, but they may not sometimes want to say what they are.
So religious people also often have a conception of the good life, what it is to lead a good life. Right. And that's when I get very scared, especially when scientists start to tell us what the good life is. Do you agree that scientists should be involved in that business of telling us what the good life is?
Well, I think that it's fine for scientists to study human nature, to study our emotions, to study the logic of human emotions, say from an evolutionary point of view, like evolutionary psychology. Mm-hmm. It turns out that there is a deep logic to human emotions, and that's the only deep theory that I know of, actually, of human emotions that makes clean predictions that are testable in a scientific setting.
Oh, right. You're harkening back to your undergraduate days, right? Now.
Right, and also some work in the field of evolutionary psychology where we can actually understand why we have in-groups and out-groups, for example. Why, as a species that needs to cooperate to survive, why we've developed emotions for punishing those who refuse to cooperate, who try to cheat. And so it turns out that there's a very, very deep logic of human emotions that comes out of evolutionary psychology. And on this, I'm in pretty deep agreement with some writing by Steven Pinker he's got some wonderful books, the Blank Slate and The Better Angels of Our Nature, where he makes the argument that only by really understanding human nature and its logic can we understand what we're doing politically, sociologically, that's useful, that brings out the better angels of human nature, and what we're doing that doesn't work, that brings out the darker side of human nature. And there's both, and it involves recognizing that we have both, not turning a blind eye to the dark side of human nature.
Don, I'm sorry to tell you, I have to get back in my car and go back home because we've clearly are not going to get along here.
Oh, great.
Well, I'm skeptical of most of the things you just said, which I didn't expect. I didn't know you... We're friendly toward those concepts, but is this sort of, I'd love to get into that. It's not exactly why we're here, but let me talk about my father for a second.
Absolutely.
If you don't mind. So he came from a fundamentalist religious background. His parents were Mormons and his father was a Mormon minister. Yeah. And so, it's the word of God. It's true and it's real and there's no questioning it. Right. And he rejected it completely outright in college, similar to what you did. But what he did was he made the Enlightenment move, the capital E Enlightenment move, rejecting religion in favor of science and became, to me, science became a religion to him. I mean, that's how I think the term scientism means something to me, which is this belief in science that it is the portal to truth and reality. Right. And I've heard a lot of actually your critics talk that way. Right. And it's going to be interesting to sort of suss out how you can reconcile your friendliness towards Pinker, your actual friendship with Sam Harris, right? And
Pinker.
Yeah. And Pinker, right, I'm sure, yeah. And your work challenging a lot of, I think, what they say, right? You have major differences with them on this stuff. Okay.
Right.
So we're not clearly identical at all.
It's good.
Yeah, it is very good. So my father, when I started to challenge the idea of reality and an external truth outside of human consciousness, would yell. I mean, yell at me.
Oh, wow.
It was an existential threat, seemed to be. Wow. And that's the way he took it, And I've made arguments that are way more, in my view, far more controversial than this. But I have ever since found that similar kind of emotional response to this, especially from people from STEM, from science and technology, engineering, and mathematics. So, which caught me by surprise at first. And you've had similar experiences, right? You've had anger directed at you. People get very...
Right.
And, more than annoyed.
Right. And fear. When I say that we're not seeing reality as it is, that mm-hmm. space and time aren't fundamental. There's a reality that's utterly unlike anything that we perceive. That and people think that they can dismiss it out of hand, and I answer a couple of their dismissals, and all of a sudden they realize that it can't be trivially dismissed. Then sometimes I see just outright fear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's scary.
And I would think some anger, though. I mean, isn't it? It's an existential threat to someone who's devoted their lives to science right. in that framework, right? There's a way of thinking right. of science as that, as a portal to truth. And then there's another way of looking at science as perpetual skepticism, right? A lot of right. scientists talk about science as perpetual skepticism.
Right. So yeah. No,
is that right? I mean, I'm not a scientist, but it seems that way to me.
Well, yeah. So I think that, well, I'll speak about myself on science. I think that what might seem like contradictory beliefs about science in this regard.
I love it.
I think that it's a legitimate goal for a scientist to try to come up with a true theory. And I don't think that we've ever succeeded.
Yeah, I've heard you say this. I love this.
And so
you've said that every theory is wrong, right?
That's right.
Every theory, even right. the famous ones.
That's right, but not trivially wrong. It's not like
absolutely.
Like I'm saying, you know, like some quack that, you know, I've got a better idea than quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. And no. Quantum mechanics, general relativity, special relativity, evolution by natural selection, these are incredibly beautiful theories.
Beautiful is the word.
They're very beautiful. Mm-hmm. They're explanatory power for a lot of data. Mm-hmm. Not all data, but mm-hmm. a wide range of data is incredible.
Now we're agreeing. Yes.
So on that, so it's, and I think that just like Newton's theory mm-hmm. reigned for three centuries or something like that, mm-hmm. it's incredibly beautiful. It's very, very simple, very, very powerful. It explains almost everything. And yet it's deeply, deeply conceptually wrong at the core.
You could say the same thing about the Bible.
Right. That's right.
I was going to say compelling is another word I would use.
Right. Yeah. It's compelling.
Like the Bible.
Right. Right.
A great narrative. Great story.
Great. But some deep flaws.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
A lot of good to learn from. Uh-huh. By the way, I'm not rejecting anything, you know, too core, out of hand. And, you know, it's not that kind of dismissal. Mm-hmm. It's rather, you know, you have to pick and choose the ideas for yourself. What makes sense? What is worth keeping? What do you think is nonsense and so forth? And the same is true in all of our sciences. But in the sciences, right, when you have a theory like quantum field theory or special and general relativity, you, as a scientist, you're not really qualified to critique them until you know them. Mm. And I'm talking about as a scientist, an outsider, an intellectual. But I'm saying for a scientist mm-hmm. to be taken seriously, you're not in a position to critique them unless you understand them
sure.
and can start to point out the limitations. And the idea will be that whatever deeper theory we come up with is not going to, in general, dismiss all the stuff that was in the earlier scientific theories. Einstein doesn't dismiss all of Newton. There's a lot of, we still use Newton, and mm-hmm. Newton is beautiful. But Einstein takes it a step deeper. Mm-hmm. But Einstein still has space and time, and I'm saying we're going to need to take it a step deeper outside of space and time and get a dynamics, a scientifically precise theory of something outside of space and time with the restriction that when we project our deeper theory back into space and time, we need to get back Einstein. We need to get back quantum field theory. So all that good science, mm-hmm. as beautiful as it is, as predictive as it is going to have to be replaced by something far deeper, but that deeper thing is going to be constrained by the theories we have. Our deeper theory must project to the theories that we know and love.
Okay.
Or generalize them.
Yep.
Or the deeper theory is wrong. So if I propose a deeper theory and I can't get back special relativity and quantum field theory as a projection, then I'm not going to believe my deeper theory. That's how much, so you can mm-hmm. see that, so I think that these theories are not deeply right.
Uh-huh.
Quantum field. I think they're beautiful. They're not deeply right, but they're right in a domain, and I better get them back in that domain, or I'm wrong.
Okay. You have used the word deeper, I think, about 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that? How is Einstein's theory deeper than Newton's theory?
So Einstein actually forced us to go deeper into the concepts of space and time and to look at their structure. The very concept of mass and of position and velocity are very, very different in mm-hmm. Einstein. So in Newton, there's a universal time that a clock ticks for everybody simultaneously. And there's a notion of simultaneity. Mm-hmm. In Einstein, there's not one clock that ticks for everybody.
That's right.
The notion of simultaneity is very, very problematic. Mm-hmm. And in Newton, space has the shape it has, mm-hmm. and it's Euclidean. In Einstein, especially in general relativity, the shape of space is changing all the time, and it's in general not Euclidean, it's non-Euclidean, mm-hmm. it's curved. And the very notion of mass itself is quite different. In Newton, the mass is whatever it is. In Einstein, the mass increases with the velocity. Mm-hmm. And as the velocity gets higher and higher, closer to the speed of light, the mass gets larger and larger until you would take infinite energy to accelerate you past the speed of light, and you can't do it.
I was scared. I'm going to ask again, what do you mean by deeper? Do you mean closer to the core of truth?
Well, yeah, so...
You do.
Well, I'll say this. I'm not sure that Einstein is deeper in the sense of being closer to the truth than Newton.
Okay.
He certainly is deeper in the sense that he covers a broader range of phenomena that we can test.
Broader, yes.
And that his framework conceptually can be viewed as more general than Newton's and includes Newton as a special case. For example, in some cases you can think of Newton as the limit of Einstein as the speed of light goes to infinity. Mm-hmm. And you can think of Newton as the limit of quantum mechanics as Planck's constant goes to zero, at least certain aspects of it. And so when we can capture all of the predictions of Newton and more with a richer repertoire, in that sense, it's deeper. Now, the question about whether it's also closer to the truth, I hope so. But you know, one thing a scientist will tell you is that you can never prove a theory.
Yeah.
You can only get... And in fact, in many cases, there's this falsification criterion of Karl Popper that you can falsify theories. Even that may be too strong. I would say as a Bayesian, I would say that falsification may be too strong. But what we can do is, as we collect new data, our posterior belief mm-hmm. in a theory can be increased mm-hmm. or decreased. So we can, as good Bayesians, we can increase or decrease the credence that we give two theories. Outright falsifiability. There's some good work in philosophy by Willard von Orman Quine and others saying that, well, you know, there's so many aspects to a theory. If the data that you get seem to be contradicting the theory, well, maybe it's contradicting the whole apparatus and all the side assumptions that are going. You don't know which of these little assumptions is the critical one. So it's hard to know what's been falsified, if anything's been falsified. So what you have to do as a scientist, and, you know, it's messy. Hmm. It's not clean and so forth. We have to see when our theories diverge from data, what parts of the theories are we willing to walk away from, or do we need to modify and so forth. But I said earlier that I think it's a legitimate goal to try to get true scientific theories. And so I don't think there's a contradiction in the following sense. Hmm. On the one hand, I think it's a legitimate goal. On the other hand, I don't think we've ever succeeded. Hmm. And so there's this interesting tension. And also, I don't think that we could ever prove our theories true. And I also, in many cases, don't think that we could absolutely prove a theory false. And, you know, I think that I would say Newton is not right, uh-huh. But he's not totally wrong, uh-huh. right?
Right.
That uh-huh. kind of thing. So when I go after a deeper theory, what I want is a theory outside now of space and time that doesn't even use the actual predicates, space, mm-hmm. time, Hilbert spaces, unitary evolution, that uses none of those concepts that we have in our current physics,
yep.
of quantum mechanics and special and general relativity. It will be deeper in that it will have a different set of predicates and a mapping into the predicates of space and time and Hilbert spaces and unitary evolution that predicts all the stuff that the current theories can predict,
yep.
but it also predicts more. That's what I mean by a deeper theory. Now, as a scientist, then, I'm hoping that it's getting closer to truth, and I think it's a legitimate hope for scientists to go after truth, but I'll also confess, can I ever know that I've gotten there? I don't think so.
Yeah. So, okay.
That's an interesting
So first of all, I will stay now. I will not get back in my car and leave because that was great. This is when you start to bend my mind in places I've never gone. So oh, that's good. Great. But I also like a lot of what you're, I think you're saying here. No theory can be proven. No scientific theory has ever been correct right. so far. And how much, I mean, we're talking about centuries now. Right. You're talking about modern science, I take it. Right. Right. Yet you carry on with it.
Right. That's right.
What's his name? There's a guy at Arizona State who said the same thing. He said, what, he's a scientist. He's been on the Rogan show. What's his name? Anyway, he said something like, I don't believe any theory can be proven. I don't really believe that science can ever prove anything. He's talking the way you do. So he faces an existential crisis every morning when he gets up, and why get out of bed and do more science? You know, it's just, why do you? I mean, isn't that sort of a religious faith in a sense? That you're going to eventually, or one of you will eventually find something that's true?
Yeah, it strikes me that way.
I find it kind of charming. I don't mind it, but I just wonder what gets you out of bed if you have that belief. Right?
Yeah, it is interesting because psychologically for me, every day, I don't have an existential crisis. Every day I wake up chomping at the bit to jump into the math, jump into the, yeah. I mean, I'm just really eager. I'm just a kid having fun. It's just, uh-huh. just tremendous yeah. fun for me. And it's, there is a sense that of discovery as, mm-hmm. as you go. And, mm-hmm. and it's also an interesting thing to look back at all the beautiful theories that were believed. I mean, Newton was believed mm-hmm. for centuries to be the final word, you know, mm-hmm. around what, 1890s, Lord Kelvin was telling the bright scientists, bright young scientists in school, mm-hmm. don't go into physics. It's all over. We've got it nailed. Yep. So that's how confident we've been in the past. And, sure. and so on the one hand, I just don't want to make that silly mistake. Like, we've got it. We know it. I mean, that's just, we now realize that's really, you know, that's just silly. It's a rookie mistake. On the other hand, I think it's wrong to just give up. I think that even though I can't prove I'm right, even if I'm really excited 10 years from now by a theory I've got, and I can't prove it right, somehow the exploration was worth it. Mm-hmm. Somehow being precise and knowing precisely what, you know, I can get a precise idea of what I'm pretty sure isn't what's going on, right? Even though I can't absolutely falsify things, I can get degrees of belief on things that are pretty low. Mm-hmm. And so, and what I do find is there is this inveterate need on the part of humans to tell stories.
Hmm. Stories, exactly.
And exactly. The question is, what kind of stories do I want to tell? Stories that can be stated precisely enough that we could actually get evidence that my story was probably wrong. Mm-hmm. Or stories where no matter what you say, I can always sort of dodge and weave and you can never really... And so it's a question of motivations. Do I really want to have a deep understanding about who I am? What's this all about? Or do I just want to be right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be right. I would rather face my ignorance and then try to state things in such precision that others can tell me where I'm probably wrong and get me to probably agree that I'm probably wrong. Then I've learned something.
For me, I don't want to be right. I want to be interesting.
Yes.
How's that?
Right, yeah.
You like that? How about this for science? The theories are a set of narratives, stories that populate our consciousness, our culture, our discourse. It's the way we think. It makes the way we think richer, more complex, more interesting. It makes life more interesting, even if they are flat out dumb, wrong, whatever it is, like biblical stories, right? I mean, they still animate the way we think, and they still structure the way we think, even though most of us in this world don't believe in Noah's Ark, right? So, but yet it makes life, in a sense, even the really wrong ones, better. Does that make sense? I mean, just because there are mind, those of us who live in the mind and are interested in ideas, intellectuals, we want to we're curious about ideas, all ideas, aren't we? The absolutely. True intellectuals.
Right, right, absolutely.
I think that's what I'm hearing from you, is a love of just ideas, period.
Right.
That's it.
Absolutely. Right. The love of ideas. The thing that sort of is strange about scientists is that we want the stories, if you're going to tell a story, we want you to tell us what we could do to show the story wrong.
Yeah, right.
And that's the extra thing in science. Great story. What could I do to show you wrong?
Right.
And then I'm going to go try to do it.
Yep.
And that's what scientists do. Most scientists, you know, we're human beings. We don't try to show that our own story is wrong. We try to show that the other person's story is wrong. But that's, you know, as a social institution, science is doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. It pits bright people against each other with their stories, and each person's trying to disprove mm-hmm. the other person's story. So, and that's perfectly fine. That's how you learn.
Sure.
And as long as it's not personal, not ad hominem, you know, you disagree, you disprove, and then you go have a beer, that's perfectly fine.
Completely agree with you. Yeah. And this is why I don't need to burn down the science buildings, only the humanities and social science buildings. I really don't have much beef with the sciences. I think you guys are doing great over here. My beef is over on the other side of campus.
The new Renegade University has new courses on the history of race in America, the politics of sex work with Maggie McNeil, An Introduction to Nietzsche with Daniel Coffeen, and my new What is Postmodernism course. We also have a large catalog of courses featuring my Renegade History of the United States series, Scott Horton's courses on American foreign policy, and my histories of the United States in the 19th century and of World War II. We're also about to release two brand new courses, The History of Martial Arts with Daniele Bolelli, and An Instructional Design for Dying with Tom Nickel. But what makes Renegade University fundamentally different than all other online universities and even most brick-and-mortar universities is that you get to talk one-on-one with us, the instructors, via what we call office hours. Students and members of RU also can talk to each other on our very own social media platform, which is completely free of censors from Facebook or Twitter or the government. At Renegade University, you can say exactly what you want to say. So join us. Become a member. Go to renegadeuniversity.com. And right now, for a limited time, we are offering 30 to 40% off everything at the brand new RU as part of our grand launch sale. So join the revolution and go to renegadeuniversity.com.
So, all right, let's get to it. Let's do this thing. So you have a book, you have a TED Talk, you have many podcast appearances. You were on the Sam Harris podcast talking about your challenge to this concept of reality. So can you, let's do a capsule summary of it and remember that a lot of the, including me, the audience does not, they're not scientists, so we don't. So the language that you use to talk about this might be difficult for some people. Right. So if you can try to not dumb it down, but, you know, just try to talk to a lay audience about it. Yeah.
Right. So I've got a white cup sitting on the table in front mm-hmm. of me, and it has a cylindrical shape. It's got a handle on it, and it's glossy and so forth. And I can reach out and touch this cup. And most people would say that, you know, I experience a white cup. I experience a shape. I experience the feeling of it. If I close my eyes and don't touch it, well, my experience changes. My visual field is just a gray field. Mm-hmm. But most of us would believe that even with my eyes closed, I'm just experiencing a gray field. Nevertheless, there is a white cup that still exists and would continue to exist even if no creature perceived it. Mm-hmm. And they would argue that there are several proofs of that, so I keep my eyes closed. I can reach out my hand and touch it, so even though I'm not seeing it, I can touch it and it's still there. Or I can close my eyes, not touch it, and ask you, is there a white cup there? And you go, yeah, mm-hmm. I can see a white cup, and so forth. And so we use those kinds of arguments to say, well, of course that means that the white cup was there. That's the simplest explanation for why it's there. And also for not just objects, but space and time themselves. We think that we're seeing the truth, maybe not all of the truth. No one thinks we think we see all of the truth, but we see those aspects of the truth that we need to stay alive. So we see middle-sized objects. We don't see atoms, but they're there. Mm-hmm. And we certainly see space, and we experience time, and those are also parts of objective reality. And you might ask, so, well, why should we be so sure that our perceptions are telling us truths, not exhaustive truth, but the truths we need about the shapes and colors of objects and about space and time. And one classic argument that many scientists have given, many of my colleagues, is an evolutionary argument.
Okay.
And the argument is that those of our ancestors whose perceptions, whose sensory systems reported the world more accurately, had a competitive advantage compared to those whose sensory systems reported less accurately in the day-to-day life activities that we need to survive, feeding, fighting, fleeing, and mating. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, the ones who saw more accurately, perceived more accurately, had a greater chance, a better chance of passing on their genes to the next generation, the genes that coded for the more accurate perceptions. Mm-hmm. So thousands of generations of that, after that, you know, we can be quite confident we're the offspring of those who saw more truly. So in short, seeing the truth makes you more fit. Mm-hmm. And that's when you put it that way, you go, case closed. It mm-hmm. seems absolutely simple and obvious. And that's why we see the truth again. The evolutionary argument doesn't mean that we see all of the truth. We just see the truths that we need to survive in our niche. So it seems to give us everything that we want and nothing that we don't want. And so that's what most of my colleagues would say. Hmm. But I decided around 2008 to study what's known as evolutionary game theory. And so it turns out that evolution by natural selection it's a biological theory. You can talk about organisms, various species, and paleontology, but you can also do mathematics. Darwin didn't do the mathematics. Yeah, he didn't have much mathematical talent.
I didn't know this until I encountered you, yes.
but a guy named John Maynard Smith in the 1970s knew game theory and used game theory to reformulate evolution by natural selection in a very, very powerful way.
Okay.
So there's something called the replicator equation that he wrote down, and there's various versions of it. You can do discrete. I mean, once you have the basic idea, then the mathematics lets you to do variations on it, discrete, continuous time, and so forth. And so I decided in 2008 to address this question, first with a couple of graduate students, Brian Marion and Justin Mark, and had them do evolutionary game simulations, where we just had random worlds with resources and put creatures in the worlds that we could determine what they saw, what they perceived. All of the truth in the worlds or none of the truth, they could just perceive the fitness payoffs. And that's the big idea. So I should say something about fitness payoffs. So one of the key ideas in evolutionary theory is that it's like a game. Just like in a video game where, if you want to get to the next level, you have to really focus and grab the points as fast as you can. If you're just gawking around and just being lazy, you'll die and mm-hmm. you won't get enough points, you won't go to the next level. So if you do anything other than focus on grabbing the points in the game, you won't get to the next level.
Right.
And it's sort of like that in evolution.
Yeah.
We're here, they're called, instead of game points, they're fitness payoffs.
Yep.
And it's like, if I'm a hamburger, right? A hamburger could be really, really helpful to a man that's hungry. That's a lot of fitness payoffs. If the man is full and looking to mate, the hamburger is not going to do him anything, right? It's just not good. So, a hamburger in any state will not help a cow. Right? Mm-hmm. So it gives you the idea that the fitness payoffs depend on whatever the world is.
Yep.
Whatever the world might be, fitness, of course, is a function of that world, but it also depends on the organism, like a man versus a cow, mm-hmm. its state, hungry versus full, and the action, like feeding, fighting, fleeing, and mating. And so when you look at it, it turns out that the fitness payoffs, these points that we have to get, even though they're contingent on the state of the world, they're contingent on a bunch of other things as well. Mm-hmm. So they're complicated functions. And so what we found in our simulations was that organisms, in our simulated organisms that only chased the fitness payoffs, always outcompeted equally complex organisms that were chasing the truth.
Yeah, it's not at all surprising.
It's not at all surprising in some sense. If you do anything other than play the game, which is grabbing the fitness payoffs.
This is why intellectuals are poor. Am I right?
Right, you know what I'm saying?
Because we spend... So I thought you were going to go back to your cup, right? So your cup holds water in it, which you were just now sipping.
Right.
So if you spent your time thinking about the atomic structure of the cup rather than I need this cup to serve water to myself because I need water to survive, right, you're not going to survive very long.
That's right.
So we, as intellectuals, spend much of our time in our heads thinking about the atomic structures of things, you know.
That's right.
And therefore, we don't get paid as much as people who just fix cars or whatever it is, or plumbers, literally, right?
Right.
Plumbers get paid more than we do, for that reason, right? And a lot of people get paid more than we do.
They're doing some use. They do something useful.
And there are many, many more professions that are like that than like ours.
Right.
So am I right? This sort of fits with your theory. Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
It makes perfect sense that you found this through a simulation. I mean, you didn't go back in history, but it just makes sense to me. So there's an interface, right? Is what you're getting at in your theory. Right. That's the key component of your theory.
That's right.
That's what we're actually looking at and smelling and tasting and touching is an interface, not reality.
That's right. So the evolutionary argument that I gave turns out to be wrong, that evolution doesn't shape us to see the truth. And by the way, the simulations that I mentioned were just the start. We then proved it as a mathematical theorem. So it's actually a theorem.
Yeah, your theory was correct. I mean
Right. Right. So the theory, the idea that evolution shapes us to see the truth.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Turned out to fail in our simulations.
Yep.
And then I work with a mathematician named Chetan Prakash, and he actually proved a couple of theorems. It follows from the mathematics of evolution.
So truth seekers are more likely to die.
That's right.
It is.
Yeah, that's a change in the biblical quote.
Makes perfect sense.
Right. Instead of the Bible thing, you shall know the truth, and the truth will drive you extinct.
Yeah.
It won't make you free.
Yeah, you can either sit there and think about what fire means, or you can frickin' try to make fire.
Right. And it's only if you have a certain, leisure that you have time to do this other stuff. If you're out there just hunting and gathering, you don't have time for all this nonsense.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
As an intellectual, I think you're right. I think we're kind of dumb in a fundamental way, right?
Right.
Okay.
So then, the question you then asked is, well, so if space and time and what we see isn't the truth, what is it? How should we think about our perceptions? What role are they playing? And so I like to think of them as like a user interface or a virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
Either one. They're just metaphors, but I think that they're very, very helpful to take something that at first seems incomprehensible and makes it almost obvious. So, if you are playing in virtual reality, and they're very immersive now and very compelling.
Amazing. Yeah,
you can be immersed in these amazing worlds, and it's not a big stretch when you take the headset off to then ask the question, well, what about this? Could this just be a headset? Everyday life, is this just a headset? And I think so. The kind of question I've been asking, I think, will be just obvious to any teenager in 20 years that's spending a lot of time in virtual reality. It'll just be a no-brainer. Well, the virtual reality worlds are just as compelling as everyday life. Maybe everyday life is just another headset. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying it is. It's just another headset that we have that evolution gave us. And why would it give us a headset? For a number of reasons. Basically,
when you say headset, I think I know what you mean, but just spell it out.
Yeah, so in virtual reality, you put on these goggles that cover your eyes,
right?
And they then have screens on them that spray photons to your eyes. And as a result, you get stereo vision of a three-dimensional world with motions and objects and shapes that could be utterly unlike anything that you see in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
So it immerses you in compelling worlds.
Right.
And one reason we can do that actually is that we actually have, in the last few decades, been able to figure out with mathematical precision how our visual systems and our sensory systems work, how they actually create the objects and colors and shapes that we see.
So the headset you're talking about, our actual heads, it's an apparatus of sensory perceptions,
right?
As opposed to goggles for virtual reality. That's what you're talking about.
It's
a different kind of headset, but it's this biological thing on top of our necks.
Exactly right.
Okay.
So that's right. So I'm saying that our sensory systems function like a headset.
Gotcha.
Just like the VR goggles function like a headset with VR.
Mm-hmm.
So our senses aren't windows on the world. They're a VR goggle that is essentially hiding objective reality, whatever that might be.
Yes, I love this when you make this move.
Yeah.
Okay, so how are the interfaces hiding reality?
Right, so they're hiding them in the same way that the desktop on your computer hides all the circuits and software and voltages and magnetic fields.
Mm-hmm.
Right, if you're writing an email, you don't have to toggle voltages. You don't have to know anything about the CPU and all the memory. All that stuff. If you had to know all that
stuff. That's what a computer scientist would be thinking about, and he wouldn't get much done.
That's right.
At least in terms of emailing and doing day-to-day work. He would die.
Absolutely. Right. That's right. And we pay good money for interfaces and laptops with your Windows systems on them so that we don't have to know anything about the circuit. You could even disbelieve in circuits and software and still use the computer.
Like your parents probably use computers.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So that's sort of what evolution did for us. Mm-hmm. The point is to keep you alive long enough to reproduce. Now, I'm just telling you what the evolutionary story is. So I'm taking evolution on its own terms.
Yeah.
And I've already said I don't think that these theories are deeply true. And so I'm saying, so you might ask, well, what am I up to? I just said I don't think all of these theories are deeply true, and here I am asking you to take very seriously what evolution says. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm doing here is the move that we have to do in science. We have to take our very best theories. Those are the best tools that humanity has so far. We have to take them and look very carefully at what they entail. Mm-hmm. So that's what, it doesn't mean that you believe the theories, but you don't have any better tools. So you have to use the tools that you've got and take them very, very seriously. So what I've been doing is I'm looking at evolution by natural selection and asking the clean question, does this theory make any predictions about our sensory systems and the relationship to truth? And the theory does. It makes the clean prediction that the probability is zero that our senses even have the right language to describe objective reality.
Wow.
It's not that I got the shape of the table a little bit wrong or the colors a little bit off. It's that the language of space and time and tables and shapes and colors is the wrong language. You could not possibly describe whatever the truth might be in that language. That's what's entailed by evolution by natural selection. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have to do. It doesn't require you to believe the scientific theories. All it requires you to believe is that we don't have any better tools right now, so we better use the best tools we've got and see what they're telling us. Now, we can have two reactions to it. One is to say, so much the worse for that tool. I don't believe in evolution by natural selection. But that's not an easy move to make, because what are you going to replace it with? Mm-hmm. It does cover an unbelievable range of biological data, and it's the only theory that does. So even when I said I don't think it's deeply true, it's also not deeply false. It really covers a wide range. There's something right about it, mm-hmm. just like there's something deeply right about Newton. But Newton's notion of space is wrong, his notion of time is wrong, his notion of mass is wrong, and yet there's something that's I would want to say is an insight in Newton, even though those concepts needed to be completely revised. And that's the way, so that's what science has to do. It's not easy. You have to take our best theories, take them very seriously, and we have to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, right? So what do our good theories, tell us where they stop, where the limits of their explanation are. And that's what we have to do as scientists. And that's what I look at. When I see a theory that can tell me where its limits are, that is a theory that I just admire. It brings out an emotion in me. It's so different from a theory, you know, like a casual theory where it dodges and weaves and it can, you know, it always is trying to justify anything. Mm-hmm. That's of no interest to me. A theory that can explain a lot, but then it says, you know what? I can't explain this. Mm-hmm. That's when I get really impressed. It's almost a religious experience for me to say, you know, this is the kind of honesty that I want in my stories. This is a really honest story. It says I can do this very, very well. And evolution can do so many things very, very well. And now it's also saying, with our senses, I predict you don't see the truth.
Right.
And that means that when we go back and look at evolutionary theory, things that we look at and assume in biology, like DNA in space and time, species in space and time. The theory itself is saying we're going to have to relook at those very, very concepts, just like Einstein is saying we have to relook at the concepts of space and time and mass. They're different from Newton. There is an interesting relationship, but they are different. We're going to have to go deeper on it. And so that's what the theory of evolution is telling us. We're going to have to go deeper. And in particular, it's saying to me, you have to go outside of space and time completely. And that means you have to let go of everything inside space and time. This is just your desktop. It's just a user interface. The theory is saying you evolved these senses to keep you alive full stop, not to tell you anything about the truth.
Right. Okay.
And so, and it, now there's another issue here, and that is, did evolution give us the concepts
exactly
that we need as scientists to right even grasp a deeper theory?
Right. I was going to say, so this interface idea, is this, would you call language an interface as well?
Yes.
Okay.
In a sense.
I thought so. I thought that's how we right converge, maybe, right?
Because
right language is the mediator, right? It's between us and what might be reality, right?
Right.
And English and, you know, body language right and just the, and just concepts and just feelings and all that. Is there a one-to-one connection between that and some reality outside of us? And I'm skeptical of that.
Me too.
And, or I'm agnostic, is actually. I think you are too, right? In fact, I think I've heard you say this. I don't know if right there's a reality outside of human consciousness.
Right.
It's just never been proven to me, just like right the existence of God has never been proven to me.
Right. In fact, ultimately, a reality outside of my own soul consciousness has never been proven to me, right? So solipsism, right, is mm-hmm, I mean, I'm not a solipsist. But I have no proof that solipsism is wrong.
Explain that, Berkeley's idea.
Right. Well. So solipsism is the dramatic doctrine mm-hmm that all that exists is me and my experiences. And everybody else is just a figment of my imagination. Mm-hmm. You're just a figment. Space and time are my creation, but everybody else is also. So there's only one consciousness and it's mine. Mm-hmm. So that's solipsism. It means I'm the only thing.
Right.
And so Berkeley wasn't a solipsist. He was an idealist. Berkeley wanted to say that there were other consciousnesses, that you were conscious and I'm conscious. So it wasn't just Berkeley's consciousness. Of course, he was religious. He was a bishop. So there was also God. So there were consciousnesses mm-hmm besides Berkeley's consciousness. But so all that I have direct experience of is my own conscious experiences. That's all the direct experience that I have.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very reasonable leap on my part to assume that you're not a robot that has no conscious experiences, that's just going through the emotions, right? That, mm-hmm, that there's something.
It's a reasonable article of faith, I would say.
That's right. It's an article
okay
of faith.
Yeah, okay. Right. That I exist absolutely here and I have my own consciousness.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
We're still good. Okay.
Yeah, we're very, very good. Yeah. No, yeah
okay.
That's right. So, you mean, one could say that I believe it so strongly that I think I'd be a fool not to, but that's different than saying I have absolute proof,
right,
and I don't have absolute proof. I think it's, you know, it's. I think it's a quite plausible assumption, and I would be stunned to have data that told me that no, everybody else around me is completely unconscious and mm-hmm just going through the motions. That would be stunning. So
right,
I don't expect it. But again, as a scientist, it's really important to say what I want to say is absolutely true, and what I say with high probability,
mm-hmm,
which is different than saying it's absolutely true. So dealing with probabilities is the safer realm as mm-hmm opposed to true or not true.
Okay. So have we covered your theory of consciousness?
Not at all, no.
Okay, let's do that now.
Right. So there is the question of, if I say that evolution entails space-time isn't fundamental. Physical objects inside space-time aren't fundamental.
Yeah, when you do the space-time thing, even I have trouble. Like, this is, I'm sure I'm going to love it, but I help me out here. Like, what do you mean? What could be outside of space-time?
Right. It's hard for us to even imagine.
Yeah.
Because we think, we ourselves feel like we're inside space-time. And I want to turn that around and actually say, no, you are not in space-time. You're the author of space-time.
Ooh.
You create space and time.
Nice.
They're part of your interface. It's the headset that you've got on.
Nice.
It's a space-time headset.
Yep.
But the issue is, from an evolutionary point of view, we have such tight identification with the language of our headset
yep
that we can't think outside that box.
Yep.
But there are ways to think out of that box. And I should say that a lot of people will be going, okay, look, here's a cognitive scientist. He's saying that space and time aren't fundamental. He's out of his league. There are many physicists who would be very, very happy to put him in his place.
Mm-hmm.
Space-time is just fundamental. Thank you, Mr. Cognitive Scientist. Mm-hmm. We don't need to hear from you.
Go back to your office.
And what's interesting, and if people want to hear what some scientists are saying, I would Google, space-time is doomed.
Yeah.
That phrase, space-time is doomed.
Okay.
if you Google that, the first thing that will come up are some videos by a physicist named Nima Arkani Hamed at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. And he makes the argument quite compelling, and he's got wonderful lectures for non-technical audiences that are accessible, as well, of course, as lectures where you have to be a graduate student in physics to even understand what he's saying. And he makes the argument that the theory of quantum field theory and also general relativity and special relativity themselves are telling us that space-time is doomed. A couple arguments. If you want to actually measure something in space to finer and finer precision, quantum theory says you need to have higher and higher energy to look at smaller and smaller regions of space. That's why the Large Hadron Collider, which is trying to go down to 10 to the minus 17th centimeters to study quarks and gluons,
right,
is one of the most powerful things we've built on the planet. It's huge, tremendous energies, and that's just because of Heisenberg's uncertainty relationship. Greater energy needed to look at smaller areas. But here's the problem. When you tie that in with gravity, the smaller you're looking, the more energy you're trying to put into a smaller and smaller space, and at some point you create a black hole.
Oh, really?
General relativity tells you, yeah, you create a black hole. At 10 to the minus 33 centimeters...
And this was not predicted.
Oh, this is predicted by the theories.
Oh, okay.
Oh, we haven't done it. We've only gotten down to 10 to the minus 17th centimeters.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
Or okay. Maybe a little bit beyond, but that's about as far as...
So this is the prediction. It hasn't actually happened
yet. Yeah, this is where the theories are saying if you could go from 10 to the minus 17th down to the 10 to the minus 33, you would no longer be able to see anything. Space itself would disappear.
Oh, okay.
You would create a black hole.
Oh, my.
So this is a prediction where the theory is saying... The very concept of space no longer makes sense. Nothing can be measured in it.
Right.
And if you say, well, I'll just crank up the energy to try to... What happens is the black hole gets bigger and bigger. So the harder you look, the worse and worse it gets. You actually are losing resolution in space.
Oh, my God.
So now, what physicists will tell you, look, when we have a concept like space and time, that we find our theories are telling us, in principle, cannot be measured, then it's not a fundamental concept.
Yeah.
So bye-bye space-time.
Yeah.
And there's another one. That's another one is quantum field theory again says, if you want to measure something like a position of an atom to great precision, well, the apparatus that's making the measurements is also a quantum system. Mm-hmm. And so it has its own fluctuations. It's going to have noise. So if you want to get a precise measurement in this room of some particle, you're going to have more and more degrees of freedom in your measuring apparatus. Hmm. Well, if you want absolute precision, you have to have infinite number of degrees of freedom. That means infinite mass and, once again, create a black hole. So quantum mechanics says there are no local observables anywhere in space-time. None.
Yeah.
So both cases, what the theories are telling us, and this is what's good about the theories, of course, they're powerful theories. They're predicting, 30% of our GDP today is due to quantum mechanics and the result of the technology. Mm-hmm. So it's just an incredibly good theory.
Sure.
So no one's saying, it's not a quackery kind of thing, I'm going to replace quantum. No, it's a perfectly good theory. The theory itself is telling us where its own concepts stop.
Stop. Where the limits are.
Where the limits are. And so that's what... So this is not some quackery thing. This is whatever new theory we come up with, it better be compatible with quantum field theory when we project it back into space and time.
We are incapable of measuring certain things? Is that what you're saying?
The very concepts of space and time themselves do not allow measurement beyond 10 to the minus 30.
They love
cease
it.
To exist.
I love it. Okay.
And that's the power.
Yeah.
See, I love stories that don't dodge and weave and try to avoid being refuted.
Hmm.
I love stories that tell us, I can explain this, and this is where I stop.
Mm-hmm.
And for a scientist, what you try to do is you take your theories and push them to their limits to find out where they break. And when you break your theories, that's the time to break out the champagne.
Wow.
Because that's when you're going to learn something. You're going to go to a deeper conceptual level. Finding out that Newton could be surpassed by special relativity and then by general relativity, That's, each one of those is time to break out the champagne. We don't cry over the loss of that theory. We're enriched.
I was going to say we have a richer world.
Absolutely.
A more interesting world.
Absolutely.
With more stories in it.
That's right.
More elaborate stories.
More stories that are constrained to tell us the old stories if we project them back into space and time. Mm-hmm. So it's
that's great.
It's really cool. And so Nimar Khani-Hamed and a bunch of his collaborators and others have already they have tools, mathematics now. They don't know what this deeper realm is. They don't know what it's about. But they mathematics right now, they're using it as a flashlight in the dark. Mm-hmm. And the mathematical structure of our current theories that says space-time stops here also is giving you a little bit of hints about how to start pulling threads from a deeper realm.
To look elsewhere.
To look elsewhere
okay.
where you don't let yourself use the language space, time, position, momentum, Hilbert spaces, which is what quantum mechanics uses, and entanglement. These things, you can't use that language. You have to go to a much deeper language, and they're doing it. So it's really quite cool. And what they're finding is there is this deeper realm, and this is work in progress. They're not done. Mm-hmm. But there's this deeper realm, something that they call the amplituhedron and other structures, that can project back into space and time and give back what are called scattering amplitudes. Two gluons in the Large Hadron Collider smash into each other and four gluons go spraying out. What are the probabilities for all these kinds of events? They've got a deeper structure, not in space and time, that predicts these events better than the computations in space and time, in the sense of simpler. It's revealing something about what's going on with symmetries that you can't see in space and time, and with the mathematics that turns out to be simpler than when you do it in space and time. As though space and time is almost like a Rube Goldberg device that's kludging things up and making them more complicated than they really are. There's a deeper realm that you don't need the language of space and time. Things get simpler, but we don't know what it's about yet. What is it about?
Okay.
And this, you can see why you wake up as a scientist each morning like, let me at it. This is so fun. This
now
is like,
I see. Yes.
Whoa, I'm a kid in a candy store.
So you guys now basically have found out there's a new world to explore. You've just sort of found out.
That's right. In the last 10, 15
you don't know
years.
What, you don't know. Okay. So you don't know what's on the world yet or in the world, but you know it's there.
Yeah. Well,
a new place to go.
By the way, it's not me.
This, or what?
These,
I mean,
physicists.
I meant
right. Yeah,
your colleagues.
Yeah.
Yes.
Although, again.
Your milieu.
Yeah, that's right. They're discovering structures and they're quite excited. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But they don't know what it's about yet.
Ooh.
It's so you have these mathematical structures and these things called permutations to be at the foundation of it. And they're at the point where they're going, why in the world are permutations at the foundation of all this?
This sounds like it's on the magnitude of the Copernican Revolution.
I would say.
Okay.
Letting go of space and time would be the
maybe
biggest.
Maybe even bigger. I mean,
I would say, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
The Earth not being the center of the universe is pretty small compared to let go of space time.
Yes. I mean, this is big stuff.
That's the biggest one. Yeah.
Wow. So that's great. I love science.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now how is this connected to your theory of consciousness?
Right.
I have my guess and I have my own. It's funny, your cup actually says daily cup of consciousness.
That's
I just
right.
to point that out. That's so funny. But I have something to say about consciousness after you finish. Go ahead.
Okay.
So tell me how that's connected.
Right. So the big question for me is if I'm saying that space-time is just an interface, where the theory of evolution is saying space-time is just an interface, it's not the final reality.
Right.
And it's agreeing with the physicists now.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Evolution is agreeing with quantum mechanics and general relativity that space-time is doomed.
Wow.
They all agree.
Space-time is doomed.
So what's behind it?
Yep.
Now, I'm motivated by a problem that I'm trying to solve. It's called the hard problem of consciousness. And the problem is very simply, how are our conscious experiences, like the taste of chocolate, the smell of coffee, the feeling of a headache, these very, very simple low-level conscious experiences, how are they related to what we call the physical world? In particular, perhaps our brains, but maybe artificial intelligences, if they were complicated enough. What is the relationship between those simple conscious experiences and the physical world? And most of my colleagues in the neurosciences and AI have assumed that the relationship is quite simple. The physical world is unconscious, generally, and it's fundamental. But if it gets complicated enough in the right ways, like neural circuits in the brain, or perhaps silicon circuits in advanced AIs, then the magic of consciousness somehow arises. And the question is, somehow, how? How does it arise? And the remarkable thing is that despite the efforts of many of my brilliant colleagues, and they're brilliant, they're very, very smart people, many Nobel Prize winners have worked on this, we don't have, as of today, February 2020, we do not have a single theory anywhere that can start with neural activity or some functional property of an AI system or system of particles and predict even one specific conscious experience, that this pattern of neural activity for these principled reasons must be the smell of garlic. It could not be the smell of a rose. And this is the mathematically precise scientific theory about why this neural activity or this functional property of this set of circuits must be this experience. Okay. There, I say flat out, there's not one theory on the planet that can explain even one specific conscious experience. That's where we are.
Wow.
And this is despite the fact that we had Nobel Prize winners, several of them, working on this. Hundreds of brilliant people. I'm friends with many of them. These are really, really smart people. It's not for lack of effort and intelligence. Mm-hmm. I think it's because we've framed the problem the wrong way. We've assumed that space and time are fundamental, that objects in space and time are fundamental and consciousness arises out of it. But now evolution is agreeing with quantum mechanics and general relativity to say space-time is not fundamental. Space-time is doomed. Hmm. There's got to be a deeper reality. So my proposal is this, because I want to solve the hard problem of consciousness, I'm motivated. Mm-hmm. I'd like to understand how consciousness relates. I can't start with objects in space-time and boot up consciousness. So my proposal is to go the other way.
Unpack that, the booting up consciousness.
Oh, right. So the question is, most of my colleagues would say that consciousness starts as a process from your brain. So there's neural activity. Many creatures with neural activity have no consciousness.
Oh really? Like who?
Presumably.
You know, like animals.
Yeah, some kind of planaria or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
We think.
Yeah.
We don't know.
We guess.
Because we don't talk.
Yeah, that's right.
we haven't asked them.
we're guessing that you could have neurons and not be conscious.
Okay.
We're guessing. So then the question, I'm just telling you how the field itself is playing this game.
Sure.
So at some point, certain kinds of neural activity is going to be critical. Mm-hmm. And certain patterns of neural activity will be critical. And the question is what those are. And they've not been able to show how the right kind of neural activity or activity of circuits in an AI could create consciousness. That's what I mean by booting it up.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the magic happen that the consciousness comes up?
Mm-hmm.
So
it's about predicting, right? Predicting
and explaining
interpretations of a particular smell.
Right.
Right.
Well, and
whether it smells like garlic or coffee.
And
you're saying they are unable to predict how I will interpret a particular smell.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Awesome.
If I give you like
Yay.
the
because I don't want them to be able to.
well, see,
and I don't think they can. Well, but,
yeah. Right. Well, I'm hoping to do that. But
okay, it's okay.
Yes, right. But if I give you like the picture of the molecular structure of peppermint, mm-hmm. that molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't tell anything. Just here's this molecule. How should you perceive it? I mean, how would you?
It's meaningless.
Would you know that's
yeah.
you know?
It's meaningless.
Yeah. So and it turns out we tasted it as peppermint. So what we want is a mathematically precise theory that says exactly why that particular chemical formula is perceived by your neural activity to be peppermint. And we want it. We don't want just an empirical. Oh, that's the way it is.
Right.
In other words, that's the correlation that we've measured. Correlations are just data. They're not a theory. Mm-hmm. I want a theory that explains why it's necessarily the case that that neural activity must be the taste of peppermint.
Yep.
Or if you're not going to do that, then you're going to have to explain what kind of theory that you're going
to
get.
So this is your next project? You want to do this. You want to be able to predict.
So my project is to go the other way. So
okay.
I'm going to start. So I don't think you can do what the project I just gave you. I don't think you can do it.
Great.
My colleagues can't do it. I don't think it's because they're not smart enough. I think it's just we've started solving the problem in the wrong way. If you start solving a problem in the wrong way, it doesn't matter how smart you are, you can't solve
That's
it.
That's right.
So I'm proposing, instead of starting with physical systems and creating consciousness somehow, I'm going to start with a mathematical model of consciousness as fundamental. So the universe is fundamentally a social network of conscious agents.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So this, this is out there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But the reason why it's science is I've got a mathematically precise definition of what I mean by a conscious agent.
Okay.
And
that's fair.
The constraint on me is I have to show how this, whatever dynamics of conscious agents I propose, can project back into what we call space and time. And when I do that, I have to get back evolution by natural selection, quantum field theory, and relativity theory, or I'm wrong. So that's, but then I'll try, if I can do that, then I will have solved the mind-body, this consciousness problem, the hard problem of consciousness, starting with consciousness and showing how space-time and objects like the brain arise. Instead of starting with space-time and objects like the brain and showing how consciousness arises.
Oh, my God.
Go the other way.
Wow.
But okay. Again, the name of the game is not just to wave your hand and say consciousness did it. That's not science. You have to say exactly what you mean by consciousness, and I've published a paper, and it's available. Anybody
by the way, that's what I do, and that's what people in my world do. We just say consciousness did it. So it's for us, everything, I mean, meaning like postmodernist relativist types like me, anthropologist types, whatever, even a lot of historians, it's just, we just say that everything is consciousness, right? It's just, there's nothing outside of consciousness, as I said earlier, right? But so what are you doing? You want to have a mathematical... What did you say? What was the word you used?
Mathematical model of consciousness.
Model of consciousness.
That's right.
What? Explain.
Right. So just like, think about physicists, say, 300 years ago. And think about space, the space all around you, right? And someone says, this is before modern science, say, 500 years ago. Mm-hmm. And someone says, you know what? All this space around you, you can't even touch it. Can you touch space? You can't even touch space. Mm-hmm. You can't really see it. Mm-hmm. You can't even feel it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a mathematical model of space. Uh-huh. You probably would have gone, how in the world are you going to do that? And the guy named Descartes comes along and comes up with these Cartesian coordinates.
Okay.
And you put mathematics on it, mm-hmm. and you assume at first it's Euclidean, everything is straight and so forth. And then that works for about 300 years, and then Einstein comes along and says, I'm going to continue to use those coordinates, but they bend.
Right.
The space bends, and actually... And all of a sudden, you took something that you thought, of course, science could never do that. Mathematize space itself? They did mathematize it. Mm-hmm. And then they found that it's bending. And then the equations, actually Einstein's equations, say it bends so much you can create black holes.
Right.
And Einstein didn't actually know his equations predicted that.
Right.
And he didn't like it.
He didn't see that coming.
He didn't see that coming, and he didn't like it for decades. And that's the point of a theory, is that the theory becomes smarter than the person who wrote it down.
Yeah.
You become a student of your theory. So that's what we have to do for consciousness. You might say, consciousness, well, it's just so airy. You can't put your fingers on it. How could you possibly? And that's what...
But you're going to be you're the arrogant one.
You've got to start. Well, I'll put it this way. I'm brave, maybe, but I don't want to be arrogant. I'll say right up front that I'm probably wrong. Right, so it's not.
I love it.
It's right. I'm not saying that I'm right.
You're the opposite of arrogant.
That's right. I'm almost surely wrong, but you've got to give it the good old college try.
Okay.
And the point is to be absolutely precise. So I've published with some colleagues, Chetan Prakash and others, Chris Fields, Manish Singh, and others, a mathematically precise model of consciousness. And the point of the precision is first to start to make predictions and also to give other scientists something to shoot at to see where they think we might be wrong. And so over the next few years, I'm working with this team. We plan to work out the implications of this mathematics. And one of my goals, of course, is to continue to refine the mathematics. As I get new evidence about consciousness that I'm missing in the mathematics, then I will revise the mathematical model. But the other aspect is... I would like to predict something inside of space and time. So start with a theory of consciousness.
Okay.
Say precisely how space and time arise merely as experiences within certain conscious agents.
Yes.
That's right.
Right.
But just say that precisely.
We jive on this too. Yeah, right. Okay. Yep.
So
it's an interpretive act.
It's an interpretive act. Absolutely.
Oh, good. Absolutely. This is how I would put it. And my people fine. Would put it. Okay.
That's right.
Okay, great.
I'm on board. And so I think we agreed at high level. And my goal is those to be mathematically completely precise. And my hope is this. The work that Nimar, Khani Hamed, and others are doing with this amplituhedron, mm-hmm. which is the structure outside of space and time. So they have done the hard work of saying space-time is doomed. And there are these pointers to this deeper structure. And they've started to write it down. That's really hard work that they've done. They don't know what it's about. I'm seeing that the structures that my team is working on lead to the kinds of permutations and geometry that they're seeing with the permutations and amplituhedron geometry. Mm-hmm. So what I would like to do is to make that connection rigorous, plug the dynamics of my conscious agents into their amplituhedron stuff, and then I would have the link all the way from a social network of conscious agents, like the Twitterverse.
Yep. Yep.
All the way to how the Twitterverse, certain agents, certain members of the Twitterverse mm-hmm. use a particular kind of visualization tool, mm-hmm. namely space and time. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you're in the Twitterverse, there are tens of millions of Twitter users, billions mm-hmm. of tweets. It's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see it all. If you want to get a grasp of what's happening in New York versus Los Angeles and so forth, you're going to need to have some kind of visualization tool that turns things into pretty little colored objects that do certain kinds of motions so you can see for yourself what's going on. That's what we do with big social data. We get these visualization tools that ignore most of the data and summarize the aspects that we need. Mm-hmm. That's what space, time, and matter are. They're a visualization tool that we as conscious agents, some conscious agents use, that ignore most of the Twitterverse, most of this network of conscious agents, and summarize the parts that we need for our own purposes to interact with.
Yep.
And that's why space time. So, I'll put it pretty boldly. Science so far, all scientific theories have only been theories of our interface.
Yep.
We've never, until the last few years, tried to take a step outside of space and time, and therefore outside of our interface. Mm-hmm. This work on the amplituhedron and so forth is the first step, and then the work I'm doing on conscious agents is the first baby steps that we're taking to go outside of our space-time headset, the virtual reality mm-hmm. that we've all grown up with, mm-hmm. and just assumed it was the truth. Science is, for the first time, pulling the headset off mm-hmm. and looking, trying to look. We're blinking it, so it's overwhelming. We can't really see yet, but we're starting to get a focus on a realm beyond space-time. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty exciting.
So is this right? Space and time are products of consciousness?
That's right.
Okay, great. And you're trying to predict with mathematical precision, right, how in particular ways consciousness produces space and time.
That's right.
Okay, I got it.
That's right. In particular, I have to do something.
Good luck, buddy.
That's right. That's why they pay us the little bucks.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we're going to die out. That's okay. I mean, God bless you. I'm not opposed to it. I'm fascinated to see what you come up with. I am an agnostic on these questions. You know, I just don't need an answer, I guess. But I would love to see what you come up with. I think that a lot of things are just simply inexplicable. I mean, and I don't feel the need to, you know, explain them, right? Rather than what people usually do is they just sort of fall back on, quote, human nature. Oh, well, that's just human nature, or that's just what people do, or that's what men do or women do or whatever, whatever category, social category. And, there's millions of theories for everything on these things, right? Why certain groups and certain people do certain things and think certain ways, and why we came up with space and time and, you know, et cetera. But I've never, it's sort of like God again. Like, I've never seen anything close to proving anything. So I just say, I don't really need to prove it. I don't really care. I just love the stories. I just love watching the pageantry, you know, of what consciousness has produced over millennia, right?
Yes.
What we have from it, from the Bible to, you know, Newtonian physics to everything else, right? It's like, I just enjoy it.
Yes.
And I don't need, but I'm happy. But what you're going to do is sort of add yet another discourse, another narrative to this, right?
Well, and I sort of agree pretty deeply with the point of view that you're saying there.
It's,
and the fact that someone like me wakes up every morning and wants to go out there and do it, it's sort of like someone sees a mountain, they just have to climb it, right? You just have to go climb it. Someone else looks at the mountain and goes, well, tell me what you see. You know, I'll be very interested to hear what you see. And it's all good. I mean, but what you say, I think, is from my point of view, very deep in another way, and that is there's a question that I'll have to answer. I'm saying consciousness is fundamental and has a dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So that raises the obvious question. What is it up to and why? Right? If there's a dynamics, it's doing something. Why does it have to do something?
Fair enough.
And what is it doing?
Okay. It is dynamic, yep. Okay. At least in my conception of it, the way I talk about it.
Okay. That's right. So that begs the question.
It's an actor.
It's an actor. Yeah, so there's a big question.
And a creator.
What is it up to and why?
Yeah.
I mean, you could dismiss that as, you know, I'm not going to tell you, but as soon as you say that there's something it's up to, it's doing something, it really, as a human being, you get curious. You go, so what is it up to?
No, that's fair.
And of course, the answer is, I don't know. And it's hard to find an idea that's deep enough to take seriously on this, right? Try to come up with an idea. You say, what is, you know, so... assume the universe is just consciousness, a big network of conscious agents, they're interacting. What are they up to? What idea could be deep enough that you might say, it might be wrong, but at least it's deep enough that it might be what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
That's really hard to come up with, right? So here's the only idea that I've ever seen so far that is deep enough. And again, I'm not saying it's right, but at least it's a contender. There's a guy named Kurt Gödel, a logician, arguably the most brilliant mathematical logician of the 20th century, a friend of Einstein. He proved what's known as Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And it's technical, but the bottom line is, what he showed is, effectively, mathematical structure is endlessly rich. And no matter how much structure you study, there will be always new structure that is yet to be explored, and it will never end. There is no end in principle, no end in principle, not just because, you know, we get tired. It's in principle impossible. And how does that fit here? Well, if consciousness is the only thing that exists, that's why I'm saying consciousness is fundamental, then that, my next step is to say, then mathematics has always and only been about consciousness.
Right.
That's all it's about.
That's
all that there is.
That's right.
And that means, now there's one other thread I need to say, an important thread. When we study consciousness, and I studied this in this field called psychophysics, we study human conscious experiences. And you'll just have to take it on faith at this point, but we find everywhere we go, conscious experiences are mathematically structured. We can write down mathematics.
You're asking a lot from me now. Okay. to believe you.
Here's one way to make it a little.
Okay.
How is it that we're able to make virtual realities that are so compelling?
Mm.
It's because we actually know with mathematical precision how your conscious experiences work and how they're structured and how to trigger with precision exact, mathematically precise conscious experiences that we want. It's because we know this mathematics that VR is possible. So that's one way to help sort of suspend disbelief in my claim that everywhere you look in consciousness, you see mathematical structure. But it's really true, and we see that in the field of psychophysics. The way I think of it is that the relationship between our conscious experiences and mathematics is like the living organism to the bones.
Mm-hmm.
Mathematics is like the bones of the living. So here's the idea then.
Okay.
Mathematics is always and only about the structure of conscious experiences. Mathematics is endless. That means that consciousness has endless exploration of the forms of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It is a kid in the candy store kind of theory. Gödel has provided evidence that the candy store of all possible conscious experiences is endless. And you, no matter how many chocolates and almonds and whatever you sample, there are more out there. And so when you were saying, you were saying something very much like that just a minute ago, that it's like I'm just enjoying the pageantry and all the things that consciousness comes up with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might actually be deeply, it's a candidate for being deeply what it's all about based on Gödel's theorem.
Oh, Cool. Yeah. And good company. This is great.
Yeah, Gödel is high company.
Is this the same? Is this Gödel, Escher, and Bach? Is that, yes, that book? That's the same. Okay.
Yeah.
All I know is that my father owned that book. That's all I know about that. I am always asked, well, why do you get in an airplane if you don't believe in reality and truth, right? So what's your answer to that? How do you live your daily life? How do you live, you know, with this disbelief or agnosticism about reality? And so how has it affected you? I've heard you talk about it a little bit in other places. Like what, right? I mean, how do you move about your day with this in your head, that there's just an interface you're looking at all the time?
Right. Well, there's a couple of levels of answer to that. One is if you play video games on a computer, right, like Grand Theft Auto or something like that, well, you have fun, you get immersed, and you cope just fine playing the game. But if you're even just a little sophisticated, you know that it's just an interface that you're playing on. It's not the circuits and software. Mm-hmm. But if it's a good interface, you can pretend that there isn't circuits and software. You don't have to even think about the reality. And so in everyday life, I can just go about it as though this is the reality. Mm-hmm. And the game is good enough, mm-hmm. the interface is good enough that it will keep you alive long enough to be a grandparent. And then it kills you, mm-hmm. right? There are certain things that the interface doesn't show you. Like right now, we're being hit by cosmic radiation. It's going through us right now, and it will kill us, mm-hmm. but not before you're a grandparent or great-grandparent. Mm-hmm. So evolution by natural selection hasn't shown that to you because it's not going to kill you before you have kids. So to play this quote-unquote game, the game is, of course, we don't go to the next generation in the evolution game. It's your genes that go to the next generation.
Right.
So in some sense, our interface from an evolutionary point of view, and notice I'm bracketing. Again, I'm not saying evolution is deeply true. I've just said it's a beautiful theory, but it's not deeply true. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But now bracketing and saying, using that metaphor, that scientific framework, the interface is good enough to do what it needs to do, pass your genes on to the next generation. Mm. So that's one aspect of it. But there's another aspect. In everyday life, until recently, I really, the work I'm doing has been just theoretical work. You know, this is an interface, but deep down emotionally, I really believe this is the reality, right? Mm. Mm-hmm. It has a real grip on what we call our limbic system, our emotions.
Until you were in your 30s, you believed in a very solid truth and reality.
Absolutely, that's because it was programmed in me from, you know,
the get-go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From Genesis.
Grammar school, yeah.
From Genesis.
Right. So it's hard to get over that programming. But now that I've been spending so much time theoretically in this realm where the reality is this vast social network of conscious agents, space-time is doomed, it's not the fundamental reality, I do have periods in which I experience myself as not in space and time.
Oh, my God.
As just wearing a headset, and this is just the game I'm playing.
Yes.
Now, I have a lot of people who who come to me and say, well, it sounds like you're taking drugs, or you should take drugs.
Yeah.
And I haven't taken.
You don't need to.
Yeah.
You don't need to at all.
Yeah,
you're the only person I do not recommend drugs for.
but many people who take, you know, like 5-DMO, MEO-DMT, I'm sorry, 5-MEO-DMT, and other similar drugs will say that what they experience resonates a lot with what I'm saying, and that if I took those drugs that I would just be there immediately. I don't have any plans in the near future to do that, not just because of Schedule 1, but for health reasons and so forth.
Yeah,
but that may or may not be serious reasons.
Yeah.
But I do listen to these reports. I do read, and I do listen with an open mind to good friends of mine who have done this, and some who are absolute psychonauts. And I listen very, very carefully. So, I mean, I listen.
No kidding.
And I don't dismiss this stuff. Absolutely.
That's great.
And the question is always, as a scientist, what parts of their experiences are insights? What parts are just, you know, as you might say, the brain getting a little bit scrambled up, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's part of the scientific endeavor is to not be dogmatic either way, to be open-minded enough to take in new data. Mm-hmm. Lord Kelvin was wrong when he told all the young scientists it was over. Physics was Newton, and it was all over.
Right.
He was wrong.
Yep.
And I don't want to be wrong in a similar way. I mean, just because I think I know something, I always have to be open to being wrong on a deeper level.
That's so great. Now I kind of think you should do drugs. Maybe we should right now go find some and do some.
Or at least some coffee.
Yeah. Well, Don, this has been wonderful. I didn't think I could enjoy a conversation with a scientist this much.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Well, I really appreciate it.
I think your work is thrilling, and I'm really glad you're doing it. And thank you for doing this.
My pleasure.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To experience the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. Thanks for listening.